President Trump opened his State of the Union speech Tuesday night with a plea for unity. He said he was extending an open hand to opposition Democrats gathered in the chamber. Will he get that unity? We'll talk about it on this edition of Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With us today is Steve Prestigard joining us. He's a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Steve, welcome back.
Good morning, and I guess happy Groundhog Day, except I'm going to assume, based on what I saw, that Jimmy in Sun Prairie gave the wrong answer.
We'll always have something to debate. Steve, thanks for joining us. Bill Leaders is in studio this morning. He is managing editor of the Progressive magazine. Bill, welcome back to you.
Good to be here.
Well, President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address on Tuesday. It was an hour 20, struck a rather optimistic tone. He said the State of the Union is strong and that we're building a safe, strong, and proud America. We'll dig into the details in just a moment. But, Steve, let's start with you about overall impressions and takeaways.
Well, I think Bill and I are going to agree with this, is that, and I can't really necessarily compare from previous State of the Union addresses, but I would not say that this was a very reach out to the other side kind of speech. This was really a speech that was directed right at Trump's supporters and Republicans who may have held their nose and voted for him. I actually read the speech. I did not watch the speech except for excerpts of it. But if you read through the speech, you know, the things that he brought up, patriotism, the part of the government that conservatives like, you know, police and fire and military and so on, and, you know, mentioning Americans something like 80 times or something like that. And, of course, in the third sentence where he says, "Make America Great Again," I mean, this was really a political speech that was delivered presidentially, if that makes any sense. We know that Trump can kind of go off the rails when he's on Twitter or when he's speaking at campaign rallies, but the content wasn't necessarily different from what he has said before. It's just that it was delivered in a more presidential tone than sometimes he delivers things.
Bill Leaders, did you see this as a pep rally? Republicans were often standing, applauding, and cheering. Democrats sat somber and still. Some Democratic women dressed in black to show support for the Me Too movement. What was your reaction to the tone?
Well, there's always a partisan element to the State of the Union speech. In past speeches, you've had the opposite occur, where the Republicans stand, sit sullen, and the Democrats stand and cheer at the applause lines of the Democratic president. What was interesting about this speech to me, and I think Steve and I do agree on this, is that while President Trump made a call for unity, he's constitutionally incapable of delivering it. He's by nature a divider, and he can't resist getting into talking points that appeal to his base and divide people against each other. That's why he had to throw in a gratuitous line about Obamacare, why he had to talk about players who don't stand for the national anthem. He had to talk about immigration in terms where he's clearly trying to frighten the American people, to suggest that what's happening is these brown people are pouring across the border, bringing drugs and crime and killing us wantonly, and we need to be protected from this horde of outsiders, which is completely dishonest. Study after study has shown that immigrants are far less likely to commit crimes in this country than native-born Americans. It's completely a scare tactic designed to appeal to a certain portion of his base that he feels the need to continually kowtow to.
He spent about 680 words on immigration, but he also touted economic gains, including the creation of 2.4 million jobs since his election, increased wages, very low unemployment, including record lows for African Americans and Hispanics, record high stock market. He also praised tax cuts, the tax cuts bill he signed into law late last year. Let's take a listen to this part.
"This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream."
Bill, how much credit do you give the president for those successes, or is this the picture not as rosy as Trump portrayed?
Well, it's just a matter of fact that some of the things that Trump said about the economy are untrue. For instance, that this is the by far the largest tax cut of all time. It's not even close. And the numbers that he cites with regard to unemployment are the exact same numbers that he pointed to as being phony and unreliable when they were presented by the Obama administration to show the gains that it was making. Any honest person would have to look at the growth in the economy as a continuum that began in Obama's tenure and has continued into Trump's. He cannot claim sole credit for it. He maybe doesn't deserve any credit for it, but the way that he presents things is inherently dishonest. And I think people need to not just hear what the president says, but do a little research into it, to fact check, take a look at the fact checking that's been done on his individual statements. And they're all questionable. They're all, to some degree, dishonest.
Steve Prestigard, what was your reaction to the president's approach to the economic numbers, very good economic numbers?
Well, some of what Bill says is correct. It's unemployment had been low. It has dropped a little bit, certainly in the last year. I can't believe, Bill, that you're shocked that Trump would take credit for something that maybe he doesn't, you know, totally deserve credit for, or that he would, you know, throw the superlative biggest tax cut ever. It's huge, you know, that sort of thing. I can tell you, however, what Trump can take credit for, and that is they got the tax cut passed last year, and there is, I think, no question at all that business confidence, as expressed by more than 200 companies announcing wage increases and bonuses and investment in the workforce and all of that, all directly tied to the tax cuts of late last year. Business has spent the last the 8 years that Obama was president with perhaps the most anti-business president in this nation's history, dating back to, you know, remember that speech, "You Didn't Build That"? And so after all, not just the rhetoric coming out of the White House, but overregulation, Obamacare, which was a disaster for small businesses, increased regulations, which didn't go through Congress. I think business people note that the tone from the White House is different, and they are responding positively to that. So as far as that part of it goes, absolutely, Trump does deserve credit because there's a different attitude coming out of the White House toward business.
The economic news, though, this week out of Wisconsin wasn't good for some employees of Kimberly-Clark. The company announced plans to close two Wisconsin facilities over the next 18 months, one in Neenah, where the company was founded in the 1800s, the other in Fox Crossing, though a final decision on that location will come after Kimberly-Clark consults with the plant's union. Involving 600 employees who will be let go, company recently said it would reduce its workforce by up to 13%. Steve, why would this be happening if the economy is so great?
I think it has to do with world economic conditions, specifically for what Kimberly-Clark does, which is paper and paper products. In my previous life, I was a business magazine editor based in the Fox Valley, and this is not the first time that Kimberly-Clark has cut jobs. There is just a decreasing demand worldwide, I think, for paper and paper products. Part of it is because of increased use of recycled product instead of virgin paper for products. The economy worldwide is changing. This is not just something that took place in Wisconsin or even this country. It's certainly fortunate, I guess, for the Kimberly-Clark workers who are going to lose their jobs, that unemployment right now is as low as it is. Hopefully, they'll all be able to find jobs in something that they are able to do when after the layoffs take place. But this is not something that's tied even to this country, I don't think, and this is not something. It is something that's really a worldwide phenomenon that Kimberly-Clark is dealing with.
We are in Week in Review. You're with us for Week in Review with Steve Prestigard, who is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Bill Leaders is here as well, managing editor of The Progressive magazine. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What did you take away from President Trump's State of the Union speech? How do you feel about Trump's plan for a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers in exchange for a border wall? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. The president called on Congress to set politics aside and overhaul the nation's immigration laws. He wants a pathway to citizenship for nearly 2 million immigrants living in the U.S. illegally in exchange for limits on legal immigration and $25 billion for the border wall. Bill, I'll start with you on the exchange he wants for immigration. Do you support this deal?
No, I think it's a bad deal. I want to go back just to say a little about the economy. I think that the tax cuts and other changes, the other things that Steve referred to, are something of a Trojan horse. People are fawning over it now, saying, oh, what a great thing this is, but it's going to have a consequence to it. When those tax cuts reverse on the members of the middle class and they end up paying more than they used to, there's going to be a backlash. When we deal with the addition to the deficit that tax cut is going to create, there's going to be a backlash. When we deal with the consequences of deregulation and people start getting hurt and injured and killed because of a relaxation of rules that should have been there, when our environment takes a hit from this massive push toward deregulation and removing of environmental protections, there's going to be a consequence. And I do think that we see that the motions of the economy are not fundamentally affected by the actions of the president. And we see that in the Kimberly-Clark situation. There have been some 15 mills that have closed in Wisconsin over the last couple of decades. 20,000 paper workers have lost their jobs. This is a trend that the president cannot interrupt. I doubt very much whether the people at Kimberly-Clark who lost their jobs are feeling fortunate right now. I think they're feeling betrayed. I think they're feeling as though the economy no longer works for them. It's no longer functional for them.
Well, let's try this reset here on immigration,
okay,
though.
I just had to say that.
I know you had to get it in there. But I want to talk about immigration from the president's speech. He's laid out a plan, Dreamers in exchange for a $25 billion wall. What do you make of this deal?
I think it's a bad deal. And I think that what Congress should say is you were very clear, Mr. President, in your campaign. There was nothing equivocal about it. There was nothing conditional about it. There was, you point blank said, Mexico will pay with it. So you figure out how much your wall is going to cost and send that bill to Mexico. And when they pay for it, then you can have your wall. Otherwise, I don't see why Congress would go along.
Let's bring in DJ now, who joins us from Friesland. Hi, DJ.
Good morning.
Go ahead on the topic of immigration.
So, I don't consider myself a Republican or a Democrat, but my big frustration is the lack of any kind of unity, and it seems the push is dividing further and further, and the blame can be put on Trump and can be put on Democrats, and the truth is it's on both. I've listened, I'm not a long-time listener, I consider myself a bit more conservative, but I appreciate a lot of liberal issues, so I've been listening to liberal radio a bit more, and I hear one thing is they talk about the immigration. Donald Trump talked about immigrants coming over the border and committing all this crime.
But DJ, what do you make of this deal of Dreamers in exchange for a $25 billion border wall?
I think that it is. I think there's a hand being reached across the aisle, and again, you have obviously some of the Republicans who are still against it, and you have some Democrats that are against it, when really, instead of what I frequently hear is everybody wants to talk about what's wrong with it instead of offering a better option. And it's not a better option when people come and they just hold their party line and they sit here and they argue, well, we don't want to give you a wall, we just want you to give us more open immigration law.
DJ,
there's no compromise.
DJ, thanks. Keep listening. Steve, what is your reaction?
Well, two thoughts. As far as immigration specifically, you know, it's one thing for three, basically, because what Trump says, well, well, we'll let the Dreamers stay, but not just the border wall, but also ending chain migration. And in addition to that, going to merit-based immigration, and Democrats appear to oppose both of those. So from the Democratic perspective, I can certainly see why they wouldn't go for that, because they get one thing, Dreamers, and they end up having to give on three things on immigration. However, to say that this is divisive, well, of course it's divisive. That's the way our politics are today. Now, the term divisive in politics really means you're not doing what I want you to do. And so it's sort of the, I guess to use a term I've used before, the lament of the losing side. Democrats, even though, interestingly, I think if you look at opinion polls, people generally speaking most favor somewhat less strict immigration controls than what the Republicans want. I think there's support for letting Dreamers stay and, you know, some of those other sorts of things. Problem that Democrats have is that immigration is probably not a top 10 issue for the small amount of voters who actually, perhaps like our caller, decide based on, you know, the individual candidate or the issue instead of does this person have a D or an R after his name. Immigration just isn't that important for the majority of voters, and it's not going to make a huge difference in the midterms. I don't think there's any question that it's not going to make much of a difference in the midterms.
And let's pause right there. You're with us for Week in Review, helping us break down the news from different perspectives. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Bill Leaders is with us, managing editor of the Progressive magazine. Your thoughts on what came about of the State of the Union, 800-642-1234. What did you take away from the State of the Union? How do you feel about the president's plan for a path to citizenship for Dreamers in exchange for a border wall? Do you want to see the GOP memo alleging FBI bias against President Trump, or should it remain classified? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. The rebuttal of any president's primetime speech is kind of a thankless job, but the up-and-coming Massachusetts Democrat Joe Kennedy gave a generally well-received 10 minutes urging Americans to have faith. The state of our union is hopeful, resilient, and enduring. We'll see what our Week in Review panel think about it. Bill Leaders is the managing editor of the Progressive magazine. Steve Prestigard is here, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. You can join in about the week's developments at 800-642-1234. What did you take away from the president's speech and the Democratic response? Do you want to see the GOP memo alleging FBI bias against the president, or should it remain classified? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy, as I said before, gave the Democratic response. Much of the attention during and after the speech focused on what appeared to be the chapstick moment. Let's get away from lip balm, talk about substance here. During his remarks, he said that hatred and supremacy and proudly marching in the streets, Russia is knee-deep in our democracy. Justice Department is rolling back civil rights. He also spoke to the Dreamers in Spanish. Steve, starting with you, what was your reaction to Kennedy's Democratic response?
Well, I'll tell you this much. Nothing says fresh ideas and new approach and inclusion and diversity and all that, like a fourth generation politician whose money came from his great grandfather's bootlegging during Prohibition and as white and as male as I am. Having said all of that, I can tell you that similar to Trump's speech, there is one instance in which I think both of the speeches are exactly the same, which is that they convinced nobody of who's from the other side of the political aisle of what they believe. They that changed nobody's idea and, or nobody's mind. And I think one of the, it certainly can be said that the State of the Union speech is this one great big political spectacle that normal people forget about within about a week, maybe less than that. And if that's the case for the State of the Union, it is certainly the case for the opposition party response to the State of the Union. There's not one person who changed his mind for the November midterm election based on what was said, and I would argue from either speech, really.
So, Bill Leaders, did you hear what you were hoping to hear from Kennedy, or did it miss the mark?
Well, you know, I'm with the Progressive magazine, and we adhere to a set of principles and not to a party. I'm not a huge fan of the Democrats. I'm not a huge fan of Joe Kennedy, but it is absolutely incorrect to say that both his speech and the president's speech were substantially the same. Joe Kennedy did something that was really quite remarkable in his response to the State of the Union speech. He never once used the word I. He never referred to himself. He never used me or my. There's only one reference in his entire remarks, even to the Democrats. His speech wasn't about him. His speech was about something bigger. Take a look at Trump's speech. Take a look at the number of times that he referred to himself in a boastful fashion, the number of times that he stood there applauding his own remarks. These were characteristically different approaches in terms of what they showed about the character of the person who was delivering them.
Let's go to Dave, who has reflections on the State of the Union. Dave is joining us from Menominee, Michigan. Dave, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I wanted to make a comment on the wall and the deal that is being floated out there. Most of the land in Texas is privately owned. Very little is federal land. And President Trump is going to have to take this land away from these private landowners through eminent domain. And they've already put themselves together that they're going to fight all of this. So, you know, even the lawmakers, the Republican lawmakers along that border are against it. So it's going to be a long battle. I think the Democrats should take that deal because it is going to be fought tooth and nail in the courts for, you know, well over a decade.
Steve, your reaction to what Dave is saying there, that this border wall is going to be a long time in coming.
Well, I think he's, assuming his information is correct, that's kind of ironic, isn't it? That, I mean, Texas is a pretty Republican state. Of course, as I think everybody who is in real estate knows, all land is available for sale for the correct price. But as far as what he's talking about, as far as the wall, you have to remember that the immigration deal is not just about the wall. It's about the Dreamers on the Democrat side, but it's also about ending chain migration and going to skills-based immigration on the Republican side. So I'm not sure. I mean, the Democrats appear to oppose both of those, and I don't know that whether or not the wall is going to be stuck in the court system for more than a decade. He certainly, you know, that's certainly potentially the case. But I'm not sure that that overcomes the issue, you know, the other two issues, chain migration and skills-based immigration. Besides that, from what I understand, I'm not sure anything's going to pass in the midterms anyway, just because at this point in things, it looks like 60 votes would be required to end debate and therefore have a vote.
Well, before we move on to the memo, let us squeeze in Ned from Lake Dubay. Ned, go ahead.
Yes, this week something outrageous happened. Our law enforcement has, at the highest level, has assured us that the Russian government has attacked our 2016 election, and so we responded by imposing economic sanctions. Well, this week, 97% of the House and Senate votes, that's 517 out of 535 total, voted to continue economic sanctions on Russia that were already in place. And this is a big deal because Russia very much wants us to withdraw these economic sanctions. Well, this week, obviously, Tammy Baldwin knows that this is outrageous and is angry about it. Ron Johnson, I think, is less angry about it. But we need to let them know about this. And another thing is the media is doing a poor job of informing the public about this vote. Both the print media and TV and radio, all of them, are not doing their job in letting the American people know that this is happening.
Ned, thank you so much for sharing what is on your radar. Bill Leaders, I'll have you respond.
Yeah, I think it is a big story. I mean, the Congress overwhelmingly passed sanctions on Russia for interfering in our elections, and the president is not going to impose those sanctions. He has done nothing to make our elections more secure. The Russians are plotting right now to be involved in interfering in the 2018 elections. The president is doing nothing to make that more less possible. He's basically signaled to the Russians that he wants them to interfere in our elections if it benefits him and his party. And it should be a source of national outrage. I do think that it's been a bit overlooked as a story, but my guess is that Ned heard about it through the media that he's faulting for not covering it. It should be a bigger story than it is.
Steve Prestigard, your thoughts?
You're saying that Congress actually, with 18 no votes, actually agreed on something? That's shocking that they would actually agree
they
on
do.
All of that. Yeah, it is a story that kind of it's kind of floating out there but hasn't been really covered. And I think part of the reason is everybody is trying to make it about Trump in one case and about Hillary Clinton in another case. It would be nice if we could actually have an unbiased, neutral coverage of what the issue actually is and for what its actual importance is. I'm still waiting to see the evidence that they hacked into voting machines to change votes in swing states. There is no evidence of that. You're basically suggesting that Russians, changed people's minds, and I don't know that that's really the case either.
We're knee-deep in political developments on this Week in Review. Bill Leaders is here, managing editor of the Progressive magazine. Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, getting your insights on what caught your attention in the week's news. What did you follow? What did you share? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. The White House says a Republican-drafted memo alleging FBI bias against President Trump will be released sometime today. It reportedly accuses the agency and the Justice Department of misleading a judge last year while seeking to extend a surveillance warrant against Carter Page. That's a former policy advisor to then-candidate Trump in 2016. The memo claims the FBI did not inform the judge that some of their justification for the warrant relied on a much-disputed Trump-Russia dossier. So here we are with this memo. We have Devin Nunes, the Congressional Democrat. Democrats want Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, whose office compiled the memo, to be removed from his post. So, Steve, should this memo be declassified or not?
Well, yeah, it should. I think one thing that Bill and I both agree on is that there's far too much secrecy in government. We're both big on, in the state of Wisconsin, open meetings and open records. And I find it kind of, there's two things about this that I find ironic. On the one hand, you have Democrats saying there's nothing in the memo, but it's going to compromise national security. The other thing that I find ironic about this is that you have people on the left side of the political aisle who are in the process of defending a federal law enforcement institution that has a history of doing things like, well, let's see. Let's go through the list. Spying on Martin Luther King, for instance, in the 1960s, and various other things that have taken place over the years that liberals would rightly consider to be misconduct on the part of the FBI. It's kind of a surprise to me that people on the left side of the aisle are now trusting the federal government and federal law enforcement. Seems to me that we would be much better off if we cast a skeptical eye toward government at all levels, regardless of whether we are Republicans or Democrats. I think in the interest of public full disclosure, the memo absolutely should be released and people can make their own minds up about it.
Bill, House Speaker Paul Ryan has played...
Well, let me answer to that.
Yeah, and House Speaker Paul Ryan has played down the potential impact of publishing a memo about FBI surveillance of a former Trump aide.
Well, it remains to be seen what the impact is. I do support its release. I do agree with Steve that this document should see the light of day and it should be considered for what it is, and it should be scrutinized and attention should be given to its origin, which is that this is a partisan document. It was created for a partisan purpose. It is... contains serious omissions that have been flagged by others who have seen it. It has been said to be purposely misleading, and the FBI has come forward and said, we have grave concerns about the release of this information, and the president basically says, I don't care. I don't care about your grave concerns. I don't care about what law enforcement community wants. I don't care about its perspective. I hear that this may help me. This may personally help me, some of the allegations in this document, and so it's going to be released. Now, compare that to what happened in 2016 when you had the FBI director come up and say that Hillary Clinton's use of an email server was careless and could have compromised security. What did the president say then? Oh, who cares what the FBI says? No. He said she should be charged with a crime. She should be jailed. Lock her up. That was the approach he took to a suggestion that carelessness in the treatment of sensitive information was committed by a Democrat. In his case, you've got the FBI director going to the White House saying, this is sensitive information. We have concerns about it. We don't think you should release it. And he says, tough cookies.
Let's go to Artis, who joins us from Delafield. Hi, Artis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I'm concerned in the way that it's being used. While I believe it's important, it seems to be deliberately being used strategically to further one side's interest, which I think is wrong. I also don't like the way it seems that the intelligence community has been undermined. I mean, it's never been partisan. I think there's a lot going on here, and I think everything needs to be looked at, but I'm just afraid that it's deliberately being used and also will be misrepresented because it may be out of the section that's been released, maybe out of context.
Artis, thanks for those comments. We're going to go to Reed in Clintonville as follow-up here with Artis. Reed, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I'm sorry I was not able to listen to the last comments, but I was speaking to your screener.
Sure.
I'm calling just to say that both Senator Ron Johnson and our congressman here in the 8th District, Mike Gallagher, both being Republicans and both being sycophant lemming water carriers for Donald J. Trump, are both putting our country into mortal peril and danger from within. Both of these men are on the Homeland Security Committee, and not only do we have to work and fight against danger from outside of our country, we have huge possible dangers to our country, to our Constitution, to our way of life, and both these men that I've mentioned are working diligently by way of supporting this memo, and now Ron Johnson, of course, beginning many investigations of his own, supporting Donald J. Trump, who is a peril and danger to our country from within.
Okay, Reed, thank you, and thank Artis. Steve Prestigard, as you hear Artis and Reed, your thoughts.
I'm going to say that I disagree with the previous caller. We'll just leave it at that. As far as what Artis said, if I remember it correctly, I, again, don't understand why there is opposition to disclosure. I think one of the things for which the government can very much be criticized for, dating back to basically when Homeland Security as a concept was created after 9/11, is too much secrecy. We are supposed to know what our government is doing. And that's whether it's a Republican president or a Democratic president. And there's been a lot that's been done in the name of Homeland Security that I don't think Americans really should support. And, I mean, I guess I find it a little naive to suggest that there's a problem with partisanism being used in this particular thing, because we are an incredibly divided country right now anyway. And, you know, to suggest that the people that you know, the vast bureaucracy is nonpartisan and only has the country's best interest in mind is a rather naive point of view. But I think in a more general sense, we taxpayers deserve to know what the government is doing. And we should see the memo, and I think that Americans are smart enough to be able to decide for themselves whether it's legitimate or not.
We are on Week in Review, working through political developments, and Bill Leaders is here, managing editor of the Progressive magazine, Steve Prestigard as well, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Your insights as well. What caught your attention in the week's news? What did you share? 800-642-1234. What was your read on Governor Walker's openness to raising the gas tax to get federal infrastructure money? That came out yesterday. What are other state or national political stories that you want to discuss? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Scott Walker said yesterday he is open to raising the state's gas tax if offset by other tax cuts. The governor's openness to a gas tax increase comes almost a year after he threatened to veto such a revenue increase last year as budget talks stalled over how to pay for roads. We're getting insights on Week in Review. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Bill Leaders is here as well, managing editor of the Progressive magazine. You're here too. What was your read on Governor Walker's openness to raising the gas tax to get federal infrastructure money? What other state or national stories are on your radar? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, after Senate Republicans in Wisconsin refused to confirm State Elections Commissioner and Administrator Michael Haas last week, the Republican commissioner proposed replacing him and launching a search for a new administrator. The commission wound up retaining Haas and tabling the proposal. Again, the commission voted 4-2 to table the idea, this time for another month. Board Chairman Mark Thompson said everyone needs time to figure out how to proceed. We talked to Thompson all the way back on Monday morning, seems like a long time ago, about Senate Republicans' push to remove former government accountability board members from the elections and ethics committees. Here's what he told us.
What Mr. Fitzgerald and the majority Republican Party right now have to decide is whether they're going to allow these people to work professionally or whether they're going to insist, as that one caller, that everybody that ever worked for the GAB has to get fired.
Thompson went on to call this a witch hunt of good public civil servants. Steve, is this a witch hunt, or are Senate Republicans justified in getting rid of these former GAB employees?
Well, those, believe it or not, I don't think those are mutually exclusive points. They are certainly trying to get rid of the people who had a connection to the John Doe, the illegal John Doe investigations that took place. At the same time, they do, I think, certainly the Senate has the authority, that is how the process works, the Senate has the authority to confirm or to decline to confirm people for those jobs, if I understand the process. I think that statement that you heard immediately would make people think, well, how objective are you really going to be? And I mean, mm-hmm. Republicans, how objective are you really going to be if there is some sort of election issue? I do note that regardless of whether there is a head of that commission or an acting head of that commission, whether they look for a new one or whatever, I do notice that election functions are still taking place. I noticed that there is still a list on the on their website of all of the candidates, including the 17 candidates for governor on the Democratic side. You know, functions of the office are still taking place. People need to remember that part. But this is how the process works. The Senate does have the authority to confirm or not confirm people for those offices.
We also talked with Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany on that Monday morning broadcast. He insisted that his big hang-ups are with Haas and Ethics Commission Administrator Brian Bell for their roles with the Government Accountability Board.
They were deep in this whole process, and they have that taint. They need to move on.
So, Bill, what do you think needs to happen here with regard to these two boards?
I think that Republicans in Wisconsin are doing exactly what the president is doing in trying to discredit the referees so that they can get away with anything they want to do. This is a witch hunt against these administrators of the Ethics and Elections Board. There is absolutely no evidence of inappropriate conduct as presented with regard to either of them. There is strong support for them among the boards, strong bipartisan support among the members of the boards for both these commissions, and these legislators are just trying to haul off on them in order to send the message that you shall not, as regulators, tell us what to do. You are under our thumb, and we will force you out. We will destroy your careers. We will destroy your reputation anytime we want to send the message that you will not be policing our activities. I think it is as close to actual and overt corruption as I've ever seen in the state of Wisconsin, and I think it demands a strong response, just as the president's efforts to discredit the FBI, discredit members of his own party, discredit the media, discredit the judiciary, discredit anyone who stands to pose a check on his unlimited power should be resisted forthrightly by all of the citizens of this country.
Steve, before we move on, very quickly, your response.
Well, I suppose if you're a Democrat or if you're a Democrat leaner, you would believe that to be the case. Republicans obviously believe that the real outrage took place in Milwaukee County with their attempt to deny the constitutional rights of Republicans and conservatives to take place in to take part in the political process. I do think one way
that's just so phony.
Or another, it's not going to have very much impact at all, no impact at all, in fact, on the election, because people don't generally make up their minds based on what looks like inside baseball to them.
Well, let's move on to a new topic here. Governor Scott Walker says he's open to raising the state's gas tax to access federal infrastructure money if that money would be offset with savings elsewhere, so the overall tax burden does not go up. Last year, the governor said he wouldn't sign a budget that raised the gas tax. Let's get Mike in Madison to open this conversation. Mike, go ahead.
Hi. I am in favor of raising the gas tax, but by a lot more than what's being proposed, to encourage more conservation and provide money to people who don't drive or drive less.
Mike, thanks for the call. In the president's State of the Union, he said he called for Congress to pass $1.5 trillion infrastructure spending package and that every federal dollar should be leveraged by partnering with state and local governments. Governor Walker said the federal government should provide about 80% of the money, with the states kicking in another 20%. Steve, how does all this sound to you? And with what Mike in Madison says, raise it. Bring it up so we can help the environment.
I am absolutely 100% opposed to raising the gas tax for what he's talking about. When you raise the gas tax, you end up hurting people who are less likely to afford it. You raise prices or raise the cost of business and everybody else. It's a horrible, awful, terrible idea. Now that I've said that, as far as what the governor said, there's less there to that than I think may appear to be the case, because one thing that Trump did not say was, well, how are we going to fund this other than the kind of amorphous public-private partnerships? From what I saw, what Trump had in mind was really the feds not putting in very much money at all, nowhere near the 80% that Walker talked about. Remember that 80-20 mix has been kind of the standard going all the way back to the creation of the interstate highway system in the 1950s. So unless there's something a whole lot more, shall we say, concrete, I don't think that's going any place anytime soon.
We like puns here, too. Bill Leaders, does the governor have the right or wrong idea here?
I don't know if I even care about the gas tax. I think that the governor, we do need to take care of our roads. We do need to improve our infrastructure. We do have to pay for these things. The Republican inclination is to put it all on a credit card, to borrow for our roads, to borrow for our infrastructure, to not pay for the things that we need done. I think that's irresponsible. But, you know, this tax is not a huge amount of money, and I don't think it's an unaffordable burden. And if it goes to support infrastructure improvements, or if it goes to support upkeep of our roads, I think it probably should be done.
The public got a chance to weigh in this week on a proposal to overhaul Wisconsin's welfare program. Among other things, the bills would increase work requirements for adults on food stamps and require photo ID to use food stamps. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss testified the measures will help prevent welfare fraud and help people get off public assistance. So, Bill, what do you make of the testimony? What did it sound like to you?
It's more witch hunting. It's more attempt to demonize a section of the population in order to focus resentment on some other quarter, these people on food stamps and what they're getting away with. When I worked for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, I did a big investigative story about food stamp fraud and about the efforts that the state was investing in order to combat food stamp fraud. And I found that not only did Wisconsin have a lower incidence of fraud than most other states, much below the national average, the state was spending arguably more money to ferret out fraud than it was catching. There was a higher error rate where the administrators were incorrectly not paying people or paying people too much than there was overpayment due to fraud. All of this is a ginned up topic. We're going to try to find these people who are getting money to help them eat, and we're going to demonize them. We're going to make them jump through a few more hoops because they're taking your money.
Got to pause there. Steve, does Wisconsin need these reforms very quickly?
The purpose of public assistance should be to get people off public assistance. And as I think Bill knows, this is a hugely popular subject among Republicans. And so I think it's absolutely going to be passed and absolutely going to be favored by a majority of the public.
Steve and Bill, thanks for making time for us. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. And Bill Leaders was here, managing editor of the Progressive magazine. This edition of Week in Review was produced by Bill Martins. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. I'll be off next week, by the way, but you'll be in good hands Monday with Dean Kallenbach. After 8, we'll talk with the author of So You Want to Talk About Race, about white privilege, police brutality. That's coming up Monday at this time. Have a great weekend, and thanks so much for listening.